Right, this is now talk number three in the series on forgiving others, what it does and doesn't involve. So, carrying on now with that theme. Most people misunderstand what forgiveness is, and then many people reject it or fail to achieve it because their definition is wrong. So many of us have such an inaccurate understanding of forgiveness that we reject the very idea as being unrealistic. We can't accept the unbiblical concept that we've mistakenly got in our minds when the word forgiveness is used. So the word is understood as meaning this and this and this, which isn't what the Bible means by it. We reject that definition. And therefore we don't even try to do it. Some people try it even repeatedly, but because their definition of forgiveness is wrong, they don't succeed. And therefore they may become discouraged and give up on it. And they may never realize that the things they were trying to do were not necessarily what God even means by the word forgiveness. And they could have succeeded, and they will succeed, if they'd only understood correctly what God actually wants them to do and how small it is, how narrow it is, how simple it is, and how achievable it is, if they understood it properly. Now, God is the most sensible, practical, reasonable, realistic person in the whole universe. Therefore, if the very idea of forgiveness seems to you to be something absurdly idealistic and unworkable, and impractical, even impossible, then it indicates pretty strongly that you've probably misunderstood what you're being commanded to do. Because God would never command you to do something that's impossible. As I said earlier, he just doesn't do that. He would never ask you to do something unrealistic or impractical. And if we feel that he's being unrealistic or impractical with us, then that's your cue to look again, be prompted to look again at your definitions, because they're probably wrong. Not only when we're speaking of forgiveness, but on anything. If anything that you think God is saying sounds absurd or ridiculous or impossible, look again. It may be that you're misunderstanding it. So why then is forgiveness preached on so rarely? Forgiving others. You hardly ever hear it spoken about. In fact, when you come to think of it, all the things that matter, of all sorts of different themes and subjects, are not spoken about in churches. What people speak about in churches tends to be things that don't matter. Just the pet interests and hobbies of leaders. The things that the Bible speaks about, they don't tend to speak about. And I think probably the main reason why so few Christians understand forgiveness correctly is that there is so little teaching on it. And it's either taught really poorly by church leaders who don't know themselves what it really means, or else it's not taught at all. Now, the latter is the normal position, because when did you ever hear a really useful, practical, biblical sermon on what forgiving others is and how and why you should do it? And I personally haven't heard one in 25 years at least. Probably never. I don't think I've ever heard one. And now, why is that? Perhaps one reason is that forgiveness is difficult. So even if it's correctly defined and you understand it correctly, there's still difficulty in it. But if you understand it wrongly, then it may be totally impossible. And many preachers themselves find in their own personal experience that forgiving others has not been an area of success for them. And so, because very few men want to talk about areas of difficulty or failure, they don't talk about it. The subject is avoided because it's not something where they can point to their own successes. So they just avoid it. Now, another probable reason is that the subject of forgiving others is a difficult one for church members to listen to. And therefore, if a church leader is the kind of man who wants to be liked, as many are, then he'll avoid teaching on this subject or on any subject which is controversial or which makes anyone feel uncomfortable, because he won't want to say anything that has the potential to upset people or remind them of grievances or get them stirred up or get them to move to another church. But perhaps the main reason that forgiveness is not preached on is that so many leaders just don't understand it themselves, and that in turn is probably because they themselves have not been properly taught about it. There are hardly any good books on forgiveness, and preachers themselves haven't heard any good biblical sermons on it which they can learn from or even which they could copy or download. So it's a circular problem, and it's a self-reinforcing problem. All right, well, let's look a little more now at what forgiveness does not mean and what does it not involve. So I've made a list here. And so, contrary to what multitudes of people wrongly imagine, forgiveness does not mean and does not involve any of the following things. Number one, telling yourself that no real wrong was ever done to you by person X, or telling yourself that you're overreacting, being oversensitive, or even imagining things. It does not require you to say any of those things or to think any of those things. Number two, it does not mean saying that person X was right to do what he did to you. So forgiveness does not mean acknowledging that there was no wrong. Do you see that's a logical absurdity? If there was no wrong, there's nothing to forgive. Nothing happened. You're forgiving something that did happen, that is there, that is real. So thirdly, it does not mean excusing or covering up for person X. Fourthly, it doesn't mean sympathizing with person X. Fifthly, it doesn't mean telling yourself that it was all your own fault and not the wrongdoer's fault. Again, if that was the case, what on earth is there to, what are we even talking about? Why are we even discussing it? Sixthly, it doesn't mean being soppy and wet and drippy and wimpish about what happened and making yourself into some kind of a doormat to be walked on and repeatedly. So it doesn't mean allowing it to happen again, allowing it to be done to you again, like as if you were just a doormat. Seventhly, it does not mean resuming or even continuing a close relationship with the wrongdoer as if nothing had ever happened. It doesn't mean that. Now, an awful lot of people think it does mean that. So if you don't want to resume a close relationship with them, that means you haven't forgiven them. No, it does not mean that. Eighthly, I think I am on. It does not mean being able to make all the pain and the upset go away so that you no longer feel angry or hurt or upset about it, and that you've made yourself get over it, as they say. You don't have to get over it in order to have forgiven it. Nine, it does not mean forgetting the wrong done to you or how it made you feel or the harm it did. It does not mean forgetting, as I said earlier. 10, it does not mean believing that the wrongdoer should not have to be punished or should not be required to repay what he's taken or pay compensation for the damage or injury that he caused. 11, it does not mean letting the wrongdoer get away with it such that it would be considered wrong for you to go to the police or to appoint a lawyer to sue the person or represent you in suing them. You can go to the police and you can appoint a lawyer, you can sue someone even though you've forgiven them. Indeed, that's the whole point. Forgiving them is letting someone else deal with it. And that someone else could be the police or it could be the lawyer or it could be whoever. Not just Jesus, but you could just hand it over to others to deal with. Next, I think number 13, it does not mean being reconciled with the wrongdoer such that you're on friendly terms with them and you'd be happy to have them round to your house or go out for a drink with them or even just engage in small talk with them. So forgiveness, reconciliation, becoming friends, having relationships again are totally separate, different concepts. And forgiveness does not imply or require any of those things happen as well or alongside. Because forgiveness is something that you decide to do entirely on your own. It's something you do. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the wrongdoer. It doesn't require his cooperation, his apology, his repentance. It doesn't require him to reciprocate in any way. He needn't even be aware that you've done it. But you see, that's not the same with reconciliation. Reconciliation is a different thing altogether. Reconciliation has got to be mutual. It can't happen unless the wrongdoer firstly acknowledges his fault, apologizes, repents of it, and above all, stops doing it. You can't be reconciled with a man who's stolen your car while he's still driving around in your car. How can you be, except in Alice in Wonderland? You can forgive the man, but you can't be reconciled to the fact he's got your car and he's driving around in it. And you wave to him as he drives by and says, "Hello, how are you? Nice car." Do you see, the idea that you have to do that, which is, I'm only slightly exaggerating the absurdity of it, some people think you have to be reconciled with the person in order to have forgiven them. You simply don't. Next, it does not mean feeling able to trust the wrongdoer. Again, it's foolishness to think that forgiveness implies or requires that trust has to be resumed or established. The Bible never even tells us to trust people who haven't wronged us, let alone people who have. Do you see? Why on earth would you trust people who have wronged you? Do you see? You're meant to anacrino, you're meant to diacrino, you're meant to discern, aren't you? You're meant to figure out who can be trusted. Who can be trusted to drive the church minibus? You know, you can't just, you might forgive the person who crashed the church minibus or was drink driving whilst driving it. You might forgive him, but you won't let him drive the church minibus again. You don't trust him to do it, do you see? Now, what kind of stupid would you have to be to say that you trust him to drive the church minibus? You must trust him because you've forgiven him. Do you see? It doesn't follow from forgiving him. So a wrongdoer has to earn your trust over a period of time, just as anybody else does. In fact, more so. So it's perfectly reasonable to wait 2 or 3 times longer to resume your trust in a wrongdoer than it is to resume your trust in a stranger who hasn't wronged you, or to begin to trust a stranger who hasn't wronged you. And so nobody has a right to receive your trust, and you're not under any duty to trust people. And yet I have to labour that, because I'm working against the grain of the wood. Many Christians think that you do have a duty to trust people, that it's the Christian thing to trust people. They've been sort of brought up to think that. That's entered into their sort of thinking, and they find it very difficult to shake off the idea. But that is just sheer naivety and foolishness. And at any rate, whatever it is, whether it's foolish or not, the point is, it's nothing to do with forgiving people. And what we're trying to do today is to establish what is forgiveness. And to do that, we're trying to also establish what isn't it. So here we have a big line of things I've lined up. These are the things that forgiveness isn't. But every one of those things I've mentioned, there are people out there who think those are part of the definition of forgiveness. They think it involves some or all of those things I've just listed. Even in the church, people think that. But it doesn't, or at least it doesn't necessarily involve any of them. Now, any one of those things or all of those things could happen, could come after you've forgiven a person. But you see, they would be different from, separate from, additional to your forgiveness of the person. Do you see? If you had a car, you'd say, "That is a car." And over here, you'd say, "But this here is the stereo system." Do you see? The car doesn't have to have a stereo. The car doesn't have to have electric windows. The car doesn't have to have any number of other extras, or sunroof, or air conditioning. Do you see? It could well have those things. It could well. But it doesn't have to have those things to be a car. So what kind of nincompoop would you be if you said, that thing there, that is not a car? I assure you, that is not a car. Because, look, it does not have air conditioning. That's exactly what we're doing if we say that forgiveness isn't forgiveness unless it has these things in it or with it or on top of it. These are separate things. So this is how badly the meaning of the word forgiveness has been corrupted and distorted. As I said earlier, the demons have made sure that it is. It is one of the most misunderstood words going. Now, I'm going to look now at a bunch of other words, some of which I've mentioned, which mean similar things to forgiving others. They're sort of associated with forgiving. They are perhaps going alongside forgiving. But they still have their own completely separate, distinct meanings. They are not forgiveness. They are something other than, additional to, separate from forgiving the person. And so, let's look at these. Number one, the word peace. Now, it is by no means always necessary in order to forgive a person that you must also be at peace with them. Now, sometimes forgiveness of the person will lead to peace being resumed or re-established, but sometimes it will not. But the fact that peace does not exist or has not been resumed does not mean that you have not forgiven the person. It may or may not be appropriate to be at peace with that person. Because peace requires the voluntary cooperation and involvement of both parties, not just the one doing the forgiving. Remember how we said previously, how Paul said, so far as it's within your power, live at peace with all men. Paul recognises it's not possible to live at peace with all men if they won't live at peace with you. It's only possible if both parties are willing to. So what Paul is saying is, if both parties are willing and able to be at peace in a meaningful and genuine way, then don't let you be the one to prevent it happening. You make sure you live at peace with everyone that you can live at peace with. But you're not required to live at peace with people that you cannot live at peace with. And in any case, living at peace with people is not part of forgiveness. It's separate from, additional to, forgiving the person. But also, let's just drill down a bit deeper into this, because there are two different words that we can translate for the English word peace. Now, the first is Irene, I-R-E-N-E. And that's a Greek word which has just been transliterated into our language as the girl's name, Irene. And it is the basis for what most people think of when they speak about peace. And all what Irene means is the absence of hostility or conflict, such that we're not at war, we're not actively engaged in a dispute, we're not actively struggling against some person or group. Now, it's possible to have genuinely forgiven a person and yet not be at peace with them in the sense of Irene peace. So you might still be in conflict with them. You might still be a witness against them in a criminal trial, or you might give evidence against them in a civil case or a workplace disciplinary hearing or a tribunal or whatever. Or you might feel it necessary to contact the local council to pursue a complaint against them because of their abusive behaviour or because they're parking across your driveway or whatever. So the fact that you're going to the council to complain about this person for parking across your driveway various times of the day and night, that does not mean that you haven't forgiven him. But you're not at peace with him, are you? You're not at peace because you're making a complaint to the council about him. Do you see? Now, the list of possibilities is endless, but each of these things, each of which show that we're clearly not at peace with the person, the wrongdoer, they are entirely consistent with you having truly forgiven him. There's no contradiction, there's no inconsistency, because forgiveness does not necessarily require that you be at peace with people, in the sense of Irene, the absence of hostility. Now, forgiveness may lead to Irene peace, it may lead to a cessation of hostility, a resumption of peace, but it may not. It's a separate thing. And they or you might be unwilling or unable to be at peace in the sense of Irene, and yet you can still validly forgive them, and you may have forgiven them. All right, let's look at another word that is translated peace, and that's the word shalom. Now, this time it's a Hebrew word, which again is translated peace in English. But again, it's misunderstood. Shalom peace is much deeper and wider than the mere absence of hostility. So shalom peace means a complete wholesomeness, integrity, prosperity, and a sense of well-being at the deepest level. So, if a person doesn't forgive another person, and if he's holding a grudge and feeling vengeful, they will not have shalom peace within themselves. So that would be a situation where they don't have shalom peace because they're not forgiving the person. Okay? But a person might have genuinely forgiven the wrongdoer, but they're still not experiencing shalom peace, or not yet, because they're still grieving, wounded, violated, traumatized, etc. And they may also feel righteous anger or indignation as well. And those feelings may be felt such that there is no shalom-type peace. But even so, it does not necessarily mean that the injured party is disobeying Jesus' command to forgive the other person. So he might well have obeyed that command and genuinely handed the whole matter over to God, or handed it over to the civil or criminal authorities. Because bear in mind, that's another thing that you can do. The civil and criminal authorities were put there by God himself, and you can hand the thing over to them. You can hand it over to the police force. You walk away. You've reported the matter, and now you walk away. You let them deal with it. You don't go around and apprehend the wrongdoer, carry out a citizen's arrest, pursue a private prosecution, or even punish him yourself, take him into an alleyway, give him a beating. You don't have to do those things. You walk away. But you still involve the police, the courts, etc. That's absolutely consistent with forgiving the person. There's no contradiction. And yet in that situation, you would not have shalom peace, would you? You would still be pursuing a matter. You'd still be in conflict with the person. So, you could also be still reeling from the shock of what's happened, trying to come to terms with it at the level of your emotions and gradually beginning to get your emotions back into equilibrium again. But while they're out of equilibrium, whilst you are reeling from the shock as if you've been hit round the head with a baseball bat, and some of you, if you've ever been traumatized by an episode, it feels a bit like that. The fact that that is the case does not mean that you haven't forgiven the person. I have to labour each of these things because these are deeply held convictions in people's minds that they've been taught wrongly over years and years and years to think. Wrong definitions of words take a while to get rid of. So, if you're not in shalom peace, the process of re-establishing your equilibrium may take a long time. But that does not necessarily indicate that there's any lack of forgiveness. Of course, it could be that there is unforgiveness, and that might be one of the reasons why you don't have shalom peace. But it doesn't follow that simply because you don't have shalom peace, therefore you haven't forgiven. That doesn't follow. Certainly, not forgiving the person will prevent you having peace. But forgiving the person doesn't necessarily bring peace. It doesn't necessarily mean there'll be peace. Not in the immediate term, anyway. It doesn't follow. So I emphasize all of these things because some people have felt guilt or have been put under pressure or falsely accused of being unforgiving by pastors or other leaders or fellow Christians simply because they have not yet recovered their composure and their shalom type peace. And so this accusation that you haven't forgiven, it can come from one or more of, say, three main sources. It can come from other people who don't understand the true definition of forgiveness, and so they wrongly assume that forgiveness requires you to be fully at peace with everybody and at peace with yourself. So they might foolishly say that a person who hasn't yet calmed down and is still traumatized or still going on about what happened to them, that that person is a nuisance and is causing problems by being unforgiving. Do you see? Well, that doesn't follow. The person might or might not be unforgiving, but the fact that they feel traumatized and unhappy and wounded and grieving does not mean that they haven't forgiven the person. All right? The accusation could also be coming from yourself, because you yourself might misunderstand or wrongly define forgiveness. And therefore, you yourself might feel convinced that you haven't achieved it or that you could never achieve it, because you still feel emotional turmoil. And if you are in emotional turmoil, that must mean you haven't forgiven the person, because if you had forgiven the person, you'd feel absolutely okay. Now, that just doesn't follow. So in the same way, that if you were, for example, beaten up in an alleyway and you reported the matter to the police, would you immediately feel okay because you've reported it to the police? No, you've handed the matter over, but handing the matter over, though it is the right thing to do, does not have the immediate consequence of making you feel absolutely okay. Do you see? It just doesn't follow. It's logically ridiculous. Now, the third source of that accusation that you haven't forgiven the person comes from demons. They whisper lies into your mind, tell you, they accuse you that you're not being forgiving, you're being unforgiving, you're disobeying what Jesus said. Now, they don't say that because they want you to obey what Jesus said. They don't say that because they want you to become forgiving or because they want you to obey God's word. They make that accusation because they simply want to increase your wretchedness and add to your misery. They also want to mislead you, to make you think that you haven't done something that you have done. Do you see? And so they're just lying to you by making you feel guilt and shame and hopelessness and frustration, when the truth is you've already done the thing that you're supposed to do. But you're being tricked into thinking you haven't done it. And a demon will deceive you in any way that he possibly can. But he will particularly want to deceive you in areas which are the most important areas. And that is one of them. Tricking you into thinking that you can't forgive or haven't forgiven or can never forgive or whatever is a really big achievement for them. All right, let's move on to another word that isn't forgiveness. So we're adding to our vocabulary all sorts of words which are not forgiveness, but which are in the public mind widely taken to be the same as or part of or inextricably linked to or required to be alongside forgiveness. Well, the next one is mercy. Now, the word mercy is obviously linked to forgiveness indirectly, but it's not the same thing. And perhaps the simplest and best definition of mercy is that it's where person A, who's usually in a position of power, strength, or authority of some kind, chooses not to do or not to give to person B what person B deserves. It's not doing what they deserve. It's not giving them what they deserve. And God's mercy to us is not giving us what we deserve to have. Now, the point for our present purposes is that even when we genuinely obey Jesus' command to forgive, it does not necessarily follow that we must also show mercy. Showing mercy is a separate additional step which may or may not be appropriate. It goes beyond forgiveness. It's separate from forgiveness. So person A might truly forgive person B by handing the matter over to God or by handing it over to the police or the civil authorities to deal with it. Person A then walks away and seeks no vengeance or retribution for himself. Yet person A might choose at the same time not to show mercy. So mercy is a separate and additional step to take, and it goes beyond forgiveness. See? So, for example, he would be doing nothing wrong if person A chose to tell the police that he wants person B to be prosecuted. So the police might say, "What would you like us to do about this?" And you'd say, "Well, I'd like you to prosecute the matter." Okay? That's perfectly all right. That would not be a failure to forgive. It would be a decision not to show mercy. Do you see? And it's really important in all aspects of theology, but simply in life generally, to define words correctly. So when you choose to say to the police, yes, I'd like him to be prosecuted, don't say, I've chosen not to forgive the man. Say, I've chosen not to grant him mercy. Do you see? That's the correct way to put it. You say, I have forgiven him, but I will not, on this occasion, show mercy to him. I want him prosecuted. But alternatively, you might go beyond forgiveness and you might say to the police, I have forgiven him, and now, let's imagine you've been to one of my training days and you say to the police, I have forgiven him, and now, as a separate additional step, I also choose to show mercy to him. And I'm going to say to you now, police force, please don't press any charges against person B. I want that to drop the matter. I don't want to see his life blighted by receiving a criminal record. Now, that would be to show mercy to person B. But when you do that, that's not you forgiving person B. That's you showing mercy to him over and above forgiving him. Do you see? Now, if person A said that, they'd be showing mercy. Another word for that, you could call it clemency. Now, we usually use the word clemency. Clemency is a kind of mercy. It's a subcategory of mercy. You mainly use the word clemency when you speak about a person who's in a position of authority or power and chooses not to exercise that power. And another word that you could use, which really means mercy, is magnanimity. Now, magnanimity is the kind of mercy that is shown by the victor to the loser in a war or a battle of some kind, where the victor, the stronger party in that dispute, chooses not to press home his victory, not to require the full fruits of his victory from the loser. Do you see? So at the end of World War II, Churchill, having pursued the war with great vigour and having been thoroughly in charge of the whole campaign of Bomber Command, which he was totally behind, absolutely in favour of, having bombed Germany to smithereens, at the end of the war, having won the war, his complete approach altered. And then his motto was, in victory, magnanimity. When you've been victorious, now change. Now become magnanimous. So what he did was, he said, let us not impose upon the Germans the full measure of sanctions and punishment that we could give to them. Because in World War I, at the Treaty of Versailles, many think, the general consensus of history is, that the Allies were too vengeful on the Germans and imposed sanctions on them, which they simply couldn't pay, which led to hyperinflation in Germany and led on to the rise of Hitler. But anyway, the point is that what was done in World War II, instead of giving them what they deserved, we chose not to give the Germans what they deserved. We showed magnanimity. I mention these words because they are words which mean the same as mercy, but are used, they apply to particular situations. So the winner shows magnanimity. And you have the upper hand, but you choose not to use it. And Churchill described the Germans as lying prostrate at our feet. That's how he said. And that's what they were. They were lying at our feet. We could have done what we wanted to them. And he chose, even though they were lying at his feet, to send food into Germany, to send relief and aid into Germany, medical supplies into Germany. That's what we did. That's magnanimity. Now, that's not the same as forgiving. Do you see? It's a separate word. I'm trying to labour this. Each of these words must be given its own meaning and spoken of separately. So it may or may not be right to show mercy in any of its various forms. The point is that whether it is right or not to do it, it's different from and additional to forgiving the person. So, in other words, person A may have genuinely forgiven person B for the assault or the theft or the whatever, but he still feels that it's necessary and appropriate for justice to take its course. Therefore, he chooses to go to the police rather than show mercy by not going to the police. Do you see? That does not mean that he hasn't forgiven person B. It means that he has not chosen to show mercy. See? So let's use the right words for things. If we use the right words, we get a lot less confused. But can you see how confused you would get if whenever you speak about forgiveness, you might mean any one or more of these words, some of which I haven't gone on to yet, but, you know, you might mean, it'd be like saying, whenever you say the word cabbage, you don't necessarily just mean cabbage, you mean any kind of vegetable. Do you see? Carrot, parsnip, those are all cabbage. Every time you say the word cabbage, you might mean tomato, you might mean potato, you might... Can you see how confused you would get? And, you know, the... But do you notice also how many demons deceive us into thinking that cabbage means tomato or parsnip? They don't waste their time. They're not bothered whether you understand those words correctly, are they? It's the words that matter that they don't want you to understand. Okay, now let's look at another word that does not mean the same as forgiveness, although it often crops up in a nearby place. You know, it's like how nettles and dock leaves are often found in similar places, but a nettle is not a dock leaf. Do you see? The fact that they're found often in the same place does not mean that the one is the other. So, the next one to look at is grace or graciousness. Now, we saw that mercy is not giving people what they do deserve. Now, grace, the best definition of grace is it's the other side of the same coin. Grace means giving people what they don't deserve. Okay? That's what grace is. So, if we were to extend the points we've made already, you could imagine various factual situations arising where it would be right, in fact, where it would even be essential, to forgive person B, but not necessarily to show grace to person B. Not necessarily to give B something that he doesn't deserve. Can you see how that's a separate decision you need to make? You've forgiven him. You either do or don't think it would be appropriate to give him something that he doesn't deserve. So person B has wronged you. You can genuinely forgive him. Now God himself might or might not want you to go further than that and show grace to him. I grant you that sometimes God does want you to do that, but sometimes God does not want you to do that. And you mustn't assume that it's automatic or that it's obvious that he does, because it isn't. Or it might be that God wants you to show grace in a particular way, but not in another way. Or he might want you to show grace up to a certain point, but not beyond that point. So therefore, if you choose not to help person B, who's wronged you, or not to give them a favour or a privilege or a gift of some kind, that would not mean that you have not genuinely forgiven them. Because showing such grace towards them, such undeserved favour towards them, might or might not be wise or appropriate. That is, it might or might not be God's will for you to do it in those circumstances. And you can't make a general rule, but even more importantly, you can't equate showing grace to people with forgiving people. They are not the same thing. And you mustn't accuse other people or yourself of failing to forgive merely because you choose not to go beyond that by showing grace to a particular person in that situation. It does not follow. But let's look at it slightly differently. What if you were so full of bitterness and so much full of the desire for vengeance that not only were you reporting it to the police or something, but you were reveling in your decision to withhold grace from the wrongdoer and taking pleasure from withholding it? Now, if you were reveling in it and brooding on it and thinking on it all the time, then that would be wrong. And it might well indicate that you haven't actually truly forgiven the wrongdoer. You haven't actually stepped aside. You haven't actually handed it over and walked away. You're so wrapped up in it that really you haven't walked away. It's as if you were accompanying the police as they carry out their inquiries, as if you were trying to sit on the judge's lap whilst he's trying to carry out his judgment, do you see? You'd be too close to the matter, too wrapped up in it. But nevertheless, the point is this, that the giving or the withholding of grace is a completely separate, standalone issue. And like mercy, it goes beyond the duty to forgive. It's distinct from the duty to forgive and must not be confused with or equated with the duty to forgive. All right, the fourth thing that isn't forgiveness is forgetting. And by this I mean forgetting the wrong done to you, no longer feeling upset, ceasing to think about the person who did the harm. Now, forgetting is a much misunderstood word which is frequently confused with forgiving. And therefore, if person A can't or can't yet forget what was done to him, it does not mean that he hasn't genuinely forgiven person B. Because the command to forgive others does not extend to also forgetting what they did or how it made you feel. Now, if Jesus had wanted to command that we also forget about the offence as well, then he would have said so. But he never said so, you see. Now, one reason why Jesus did not command us to forget about it, about the wrongs done to us, or to forget the way we feel about it or the way it made us feel, is because he's perfectly well aware that we aren't capable of doing that. Now, the thing about God, God is able to choose to forget a thing. That's something he's capable of. But how can you choose to forget a thing? The more you try and choose to forget it, the more you remember it, don't you? The more you dwell on your wish to forget it, the more you're thinking about it. You can't just choose to forget a thing. You can choose to forgive because you hand it over, you walk away. That's forgiving. But as you walk away from the police station, you might be in a traumatized situation where your emotions have been shredded, as if someone's rubbed your nerve endings with a wire brush. And that's how you feel when you walk away. Nevertheless, you've handed it over and walked away. But you haven't forgotten, because the word forget and the word forgive are different words. And if you have got a massive IQ like me and you can distinguish cabbage and tomato and parsnip, and even at a glance I can tell the difference between a tomato and a cabbage, I've got that kind of skill. Now, if you can manage that, you can manage this, and you can tell the difference between forgiving and forgetting and not confuse the two. And although I'm being a little silly in talking like that, I've heard with my own ears people say that if you haven't forgotten it, you haven't forgiven it. I've heard it said in churches, do you see? And that's why I go out of my way to labour this. Because these kind of silly ideas are being taught. All right. So Jesus knows you can't just choose to forget. And that's why he never commands you to do a thing you can't do. Jesus never commands you to run 100 metres in 10 seconds. He never ever tells you to do that. He never tells you to do things you can't do. Everything that you're commanded to do is something that you could do. You might not choose to do it, but you could choose to do it. So we can't just forget as an exercise of our will. We may be able to forget as time goes by, but forgetting has more to do with your feelings calming down. So someone has wire brushed your nerve endings. It may be that 3 months later, 6 months later, you've recovered your equilibrium and you no longer find yourself thinking about it all the time. The pain has begun to wear off, the shock, and you suddenly realise, I haven't thought about that for nearly 3 days. Do you see? And that's a sign that you're beginning to recover. But it's not a command. It's something that you might aspire to, hope for, seek for, pray for, but it's not something which you are under a duty to do. Okay, let's look at another one. Number five, trusting the wrongdoer. It may or may not be appropriate for you to trust a person who's previously wronged you. It depends entirely on the circumstances, and on the role, the responsibility, or whatever it is that you're considering entrusting to him or re-entrusting to him. It could be very unwise to trust that person. It could be even dangerous to trust that person. You are under a duty, not just entitled, but you're commanded to weigh people up to see whether they can be trusted. And I spoke about this when I did the talks on the wicked. I did a whole series of talks about the wicked, and one of the things you've got to do is weigh people up. And one of the things you're weighing up is whether they can be trusted. So, it may in fact be a breach of your professional duty to trust people, because you have to bear in mind the needs of others. So, if you were a leader of some kind, or in charge of a youth group or something, you've got a duty to be careful about who you trust, haven't you? And so you can't just say, well, you know, I've forgiven this man, I must trust him again. No, it doesn't follow at all. So whether it's right or wrong to trust the person again, even after forgiving them, is a completely separate issue from the duty to forgive, and goes far beyond forgiving them into a totally different dimension, which is based on totally different criteria and absolutely different subject altogether. All right, number six, something that isn't forgiveness, is giving the wrongdoer another chance. Now, this is linked to the issue of whether or not we feel able to trust the wrongdoer again, but it's also a separate point in itself, because it's possible to give a person another chance even if you don't yet trust them, and even if you actually expect them to let you down again. So you could give a chance even where you don't trust. And so the point is that the issue of whether or not you need or should give a person another chance is a separate question from the duty to forgive that person. It's a totally separate question. So you can genuinely forgive a person, and yet you don't feel it would be wise or safe or appropriate to give them another chance. It's a matter of individual judgment that you need to decide upon. And so another Christian might be willing to give them another chance, but you might not, and you might both be right. There's no reason that it's a matter of opinion. It's up to you to form an opinion, and you need to form that opinion wisely. There isn't a general rule about it. You have to figure it out in the circumstances. Now, a classic example of this is the crisis that arose in the book of Acts that led to the split up of Saul and Barnabas. It's when John Mark, who's known to us as Mark, the writer of the Gospel, he deserted Apostle Paul at a critical moment and let Paul down when he was under pressure. Now, later on, Mark repented of this and felt bad about it, and he wanted to rejoin the team. But that led to an argument. Now, Paul's personal stance was he was not willing to give Mark another chance. But Paul's partner, Barnabas, felt that Mark should be allowed to have another chance and to work with them again. And they argued about it. It says there was a sharp dissension between them, sharp contention. They couldn't agree. So they argued sharply about it. And in the end, Saul and Barnabas split up and went their separate ways. And that shows you how big a deal it was. That's how strongly they disagreed. So Barnabas took Mark and Paul took Silas, and they went their separate ways. And we read about this in Acts 15, 36 to 41. Let me just read that bit out. It says, "And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, 'Come, let us return and visit the brethren in every city where we proclaimed the word of the Lord and see how they are.' And Barnabas wanted to take with them John, called Mark. But Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp contention, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches." Now, that episode with Saul and Barnabas had a happy ending, Because Mark genuinely changed. Having let them down badly, he turned into a mature, reliable worker. And in the end, God honored Mark by allowing him to write the second gospel, for which he got the material, in the main, from Apostle Peter. He became very close to Peter. And so we read about this in 1 Peter 5:13. It says, "She who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark." So he looks upon Mark as if he was a son to him. And that's how much Mark was rehabilitated and brought back in. But more to the point, Mark was eventually accepted and trusted and welcomed back again by Paul to work alongside him. So, of course, Paul rose and rose and rose in the church he became the top man in the church, really. Barnabas didn't rise in that way, but Paul did. But look how Paul writes later on in Colossians 4, verse 10. It says, "Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you have received instructions. If he comes to you, receive him." Okay? Now, Paul's back on good terms with Mark now. This is years later. So, therefore, Mark's dramatic and total rehabilitation, it's an encouragement to all of us to believe that even where people fail badly, even where you badly let down the Apostle Paul, there is always the chance in God to start again, isn't there? There's always a chance to repent and change and eventually become a success. Now, the question then is, who was right, Paul or Barnabas? Now, the short answer is probably that they were both right. At any rate, Paul did not do anything wrong by choosing not to give Mark a second chance and not to let Mark join the team again. Now, Paul obviously felt it would be unwise and even unsafe. But in making that decision not to let Mark have a second chance, Paul was not failing to forgive Mark, because not letting Mark have a second chance has got nothing to do with forgiving or not forgiving him. And so acting in that way, Paul's decision was not inconsistent with genuine forgiveness. It was up to Paul to decide what was best and whether or not it would be wise to go beyond forgiving Mark by choosing to give him another chance. Now, Barnabas saw it differently. That was his freedom. He was willing to take the risk. That was his personal choice. Happily, it turned out to have been an inspired one. Now, that said, it may well have had more to do with the simple fact that Mark was Barnabas' cousin, and therefore he possibly chose to give him more leeway than he would have given to a non-relative. And if it had been the other way around, and Mark had been Paul's cousin, not Barnabas's, maybe the opposite decision would have been made. You see, but the point is this, that in choosing not to go as far as Barnabas was willing to go, Paul wasn't sinning, and in particular, he was not failing to forgive Mark. But you can gain some other indirect encouragement from this. See, although Paul was infallible and inspired when he wrote the gospel, the Bible, when he wrote the New Testament letters, he wasn't infallible when he made decisions about things, was he? So Paul could make what turned out in the end to be a wrong decision. It wasn't a sinful decision, and above all, it wasn't a failure to forgive. But probably Barnabas saw something that Paul couldn't see. That doesn't make Paul a sinner, and it doesn't make Paul unforgiving. It just means if ever you need a touch of encouragement, you're not the only one who goofs up and makes wrong decisions. Even Paul did make what turned out years later to have been a wrong decision. He misjudged what would happen to John Mark. Anyway, at least I gain a bit of encouragement from that, because I've made plenty of wrong decisions. And the fact that Paul did it, it means I'm in good company. Next, another thing that isn't forgiveness is being reconciled with the wrongdoer and starting or resuming a friendship with him. Now, you'll see the pattern by now. And again, realize that this is going further than trusting. It's further than forgiving. It's different from forgiving. It's even going further than trusting the wrongdoer and or giving him another chance. Because being reconciled with him may well mean that you're resuming a full personal relationship involving trust, friendship, closeness, and intimacy, and even the sharing of confidences and so on. Now that goes way beyond forgiving him. It goes way beyond trusting him. And it goes way beyond. And therefore, being reconciled to the person is a big decision. But the point for our purposes is that being reconciled is not the same as forgiving him. There's absolutely no duty whatsoever to be reconciled to every wrongdoer. Reconciliation is not required in order for you to be able to say that you've genuinely forgiven the person. It's just not required. Again, I labour it because so many people think that it is required. Otherwise, you're in disobedience, you're being unforgiving, and so on. No, you're not. You're not being unforgiving, you're just unreconciled. Now, as to whether you're right or wrong to choose not to be reconciled, that's a separate question. You might be wrong, you might be right. But the one thing that we can say is, it's got nothing whatever to do with whether you're forgiving that person. You could be wrong in the choice you make, but it's not the same as talking about whether you're being forgiving. You don't have a duty to be reconciled to wrongdoers. It's caused so much confusion and so much pressure on people who feel they've got to be reconciled, resume a relationship, rejoin a house group with a person who's been an abuser or, you know, whatever. You don't have to. So people mistakenly assume that unless they're willing to be fully reconciled and feel entirely comfortable about resuming a close personal relationship and a friendship with the wrongdoer, then they've not genuinely forgiven the person and that they're in disobedience and they could be tortured by that. But it's just a pack of lies. It's just an error. It's a wrong way to think. And it's usually a demonic lie that's been put into your mind, or it's wrong teaching that's been put into your head. It's plainly wrong, and it's a particularly unhelpful thing to say to a person who's struggling to deal with the wrong done to them. So if you're counselling someone else, a fellow Christian, or you're a house group leader or something like that, be careful. You could be so unhelpful to someone if you tell them that they need to be reconciled to person B. Because reconciliation may or may not be appropriate. It may not be achievable at this time. It depends on a host of circumstances, and in particular, it depends on the attitude and the subsequent conduct of the wrongdoer and whether he's genuinely repented and apologized and changed. And if he hasn't done all those things, there will be no valid or meaningful basis for reconciliation with him. It could even be foolish to attempt it. So as with all the other words we spoke of, we need to see reconciliation as another separate, standalone issue over and above forgiveness. And it may or may not be appropriate or even possible now or even in the long term to be reconciled and go on holiday with the man who killed your children. Do you see how ridiculous it could be? Do you see the things that people think, how stupid these things are that people think? It may or may not be. But what if the man didn't kill all your children, but he had a slight bang with his car and drove into your fence and knocked your fence over? And he was full of apology, he paid for the fence, you forgave him, and you're fully reconciled. You even laugh about it now. Do you see the difference? That's that situation, this is this situation. In that situation, of course you should be reconciled with the fella. In that situation, of course you shouldn't be reconciled with the man. Do you see? But above all, whether it's right or wrong to be reconciled, it's never right speak of the two words, reconciliation and forgiveness, as if they were the same thing. All right, well, I'll stop at that point. That's the end of talk 3.